Okay, we have one more presentation, which I think is going to be just as exciting as the previous two we had, and a little bit different too, with some live music. Phil Carley is a musicologist, sound recording historian, film archivist, silent film accompanist, conductor, composer, and is somewhat embarrassed to mention that he wears all these hats, but he did leave off ARSC member. He does all these to make a living, actually. He took his bachelor's degree from Indiana University, I assume he earned it, and his master's and PhD from the Eastman School of Music, down the street. He wrote his doctoral dissertation on American band and orchestral recording before WW1, has contributed to the Arts Journal as a book reviewer, collaborated with Bill Klinger on a presentation for the U.S. Phonograph Company for the Arts Conference in Cleveland, I remember that one, and presented a paper on music machines of the rich and famous at ARSC Milwaukee. He's co-taught a course with Jim Farrington at Eastman in the history and aesthetics of recorded sound. He's a film historian, contributed articles to Film History, The Griffith Project, and he currently teaches at the University of Rochester. He explained also, there's a small correction to the title of his program, and I do mention small. His multimedia presentation today is entitled Phonographs in Silent and Early Sound Film. Phil Carley.
Hello. Before I start, like everybody, I want to make a couple of acknowledgments because I couldn't have done this presentation without the assistance, the courteous and extremely gracious assistance of the Motion Picture Department of the George Eastman House, in particular Anthony Labate, Nancy Kaufman, Tony Del Grosso, and a gentleman who is here today whom I used to work with daily and whom I consider a friend and always, if he isn't too embarrassed, something of a mentor, Edward Stratman. I was very, that was a privilege to me. And going on from there, sound recording and motion pictures matured commercially in similar ways from the mid-1890s to the onset of the Depression. And during this period, both media went from being laboratory experiments to being essential parts of American life. But systematic examination of the cultural interaction between the two media is just now getting underway. What I propose to do here is briefly demonstrate a very few crossovers between film and sound recording in the form of records and phonographs, which may illuminate some social attitudes and technological thinking towards recording as depicted both on the screen and, as it were, through the horn. There were few records or films that referred back and forth between themselves as either sonic or dramatic devices until really after the turn of the 20th century. And those films which first appeared were comedies. There are a couple of films such as a Polidor comedy from, I think, 1910 called Le Gramophone Ravançant, which Polidor was a popular name of a French comedian, and what happens is when he winds up the gramophone, plays a record, the whole room starts to spin, and it dances. And there is also a British comedy by the extremely unattractively named comedian Pimple, called Pimple's Wonderful Gramophone, played by Fred Evans, who was kind of the king of tat. His films were extremely cheaply produced and were meant to look that way, where he dons a great big horn and says, put a sixpence in the slot and hear any tune you want. But the earliest dramatic film where the phonograph puts, it's the earliest surviving dramatic film, which puts the phonograph at center stage by using sound recording as a crucial plot device, is the 1913 sensationalist white slave film, Traffic in Souls, directed by George Lone Tucker for the Imp Company and released through Universal, starring Jane Gale, Matt Moore, and Cleo Madison. If you'll start the film, I'll turn down the lights. I'll still be able to read. Thank you. coming up. No trouble. Traffic in Souls is deliberately an immediate film, actually based on some similar films made in Sweden. And with its premise taken from yellow journalism headlines, it tells the story of an inventor's two daughters, one of whom is engaged to a policeman, the other who is eventually trapped by a white slavery ring run by the local bastion of morality. It uses sound recording as a plot device from the beginning of the film. In this case, the father inventing a device which connects a telephone electrically to a cylinder phonograph. Basically, he's inventing electrical recording 10 years early. The film is also a showcase for other electrical technologies, principally in connection with the villain, who you see here, prefiguring the gadgets later used in silent serial films and even later in spy films in the 1950s and 60s. This ostensible reformer, whose true identity is only known to his chief henchman, keeps a close ear from his upstairs legitimate office, the headquarters of the International Purity and Reform League, keeps a close ear on his white slavery office, on this white slavery operation in an office on the floor below through a dictograph or microphone. Interestingly, the dictograph is not hidden. The henchman actually points it out to his passel of procurers, petty thieves, and madams as an instrument of fear to keep them in line, letting them know that they are always under surveillance. One other thing, even though this film deals with white slavery and prostitution, this is a real hard follow-up to Sandra. There are no overt sexual situations or indeed anything remotely sexually exploitative in Traffic in Souls. The human elements of the melodrama focus on hypocrisy and rather commonplace, grubby, sleazy dealing. There is also, as one of the gadgets, an electric pantograph, allowing the henchman to send profit figures and information to his boss upstairs without confiding anything to one of his extremely untrustworthy underlings. Traffic in Souls uses these devices to illustrate inventive creativity and the power of technological information. In other words, you know, this is the information age in embryo. In fact, the ultimate means of trapping the villain is the application of mixed technologies. And Traffic in Souls is perhaps the first film to show recorded bugging. And you'll see that in a moment. As the madam leaves, she oversees the girls which are trapped on the docks in New York and brought back to serve in the various brothels and what have you. When the inventor's younger daughter is kidnapped, the policeman and the other daughter, who has, by the way, when her sister has been kidnapped, gone looking for her, she took an undercover job in the villain's front. They secretly connect her father's device to the dictograph / microphone in order to record the villain, the henchman, and indeed the whole gang. They then turn the cylinder over to the police. Because of the mix of displayed and secret sonic and sound recording equipment devices, the addition of us as the audience watching this all unfold in a non-sonic medium creates an interesting layering of who's watching who listen to who. Whether the technology of the time would have been up to what the film portrays is, at best, highly conjectural. But it seemed possible enough to filmmakers and the film-going public to appear in later films such as the 1917 Ethel Barrymore drama The White Raven, directed by George D. Baker from Metro. The casual use in The White Raven of something depicted as radically new 4 years earlier in Traffic in Souls suggests an acceptance of at least the possibility that such things could and would happen in the future. And I will fill this in a little bit from the keyboard. We pause it right there. And we'll go over to the two photographs, if we may. In many silent films from the teens onward, disc phonographs, especially upright models, console models, became part of the everyday decor of sets, including their general presence. As a secondary or supporting character, however, a talking machine plays an important role in a film made by the one company which manufactured both films and records and phonographs. The Innocence of Ruth was directed by John Hancock Collins in 1916 for the Edison Company and filmed in their Bronx studios. The Edison Company had gone into feature film production later than most of its competitors. It stars Edward Earle, who's to the foreground, and Collins' wife, Viola Dana. The story is a Daddy Longlegs type of tale, where a wealthy but aimless bachelor agrees to be the guardian for an orphan. Dana, playing the orphan, decides she wants to express her extroverted nature by becoming a dancer. To the initial disapproval of her guardian, but her talent and determination win him not only over to her career, but also capture his heart. This slight tale, which is, however, very elegantly filmed by Collins, who died in the flu epidemic of 1918, survives at the Library of Congress. And it's the only film I have encountered with product placement. As Viola Dana practices dancing not only to a phonograph, but to an Edison disc phonograph, whose lid you can see in the back. And it's not just any Edison disc phonograph. John Collins had started as a set designer at Edison and took great care with his mise-en-scène, or as much as Edison's small production budgets would allow. Here, the central piece in the rich interior representing the bachelor's living room is a prominently displayed Edison A375. Could we have the next photograph, please? One of the company's most distinctive and expensive models. The 375 referred to its original price. It was a very distinctive Louis XV style with an asymmetrical grille. And it is seen throughout the film, and you can see it dead center here, though it's not usually seen with the decoration of the tiger skin that you see in this lobby card. After World War I, we'll be going back to the films now, American society loosened and expanded its social, decorative, and technological horizons. New styles of dance music, the new sin, the fashionable sin of breaking prohibition, and the hedonistic, not to say, really fun elements of new social freedoms, attracted socially attuned and opportunistic filmmakers such as Cecil B. DeMille, whose 1920 social satire, Why Change Your Wife, includes a phonograph as a symbol of enticement and decadence. American recording and phonograph manufacturing industries had had an enormous, if comparatively short-lived, economic boom right after the war. And there was an urge for novelty in phonograph design, an urge that in this extract of the film that we'll see with Thomas Mann as the hero and Bebe Daniels as the girl is coupled with the possibilities of other urges. Again, nothing compared to what we saw before. Start, please. In this sequence, the hero, next chapter, please. In this sequence, the hero has skipped out on his wife's dreary classical musical soiree to go to the theater with a shop girl whom he met at a lingerie store. She brings him back to her place for a teeny sandwich. The titles in DeMille's social comedies are one of the great joys. As he comes in, she gives him she gives him a comfortable seat, not in a safe and moral easy chair, but on the far more dubious Davenport, which includes the latest thing, as you will see, a built-in phonograph in one of the armrests. This wasn't specially made for the film. DeMille scoped out contemporary styling trends in decorative arts and used items he found for dramatic effect. The rival puts on a, debatably snappy, Joseph C. Smith foxtrot, the faintly oriental and exotic Hindustan, as you see, on her sofanograph. Forgive that, couldn't resist. Lights a cigarette and goes to change into something more comfortable, while at the same time, the wife is listening to a lugubrious violin solo at home in a sequence I've cut in the interests of time. Upon the girl's return, she joins the husband on the sofa, and to encourage further intimacies, reveals another of the suggestive settee's features. And it's in the other armrest. In that armrest is a hidden drinks tray. Something everybody needs. As if that isn't enough, when she pulls the tray out, the decanter's inscription spells out the situation very plainly indeed. In this film, DeMille uses a technologically oriented furniture to accentuate his narrative and sexual agendas, and also as a symbol of up-to-date social interactions. Okay, we can go on to the next clip, if you would, please. Oh, the one before this, please. Sorry. Sound recording also appears occasionally as a symbol of nostalgia and indeed of class identity in some silent films. By the 1920s, in fact, these were the only ways in which cylinder phonographs appeared, despite Edison still producing machines and records. In the 1921 Thomas Ince production Hail the Woman, the heroine's home is governed by her overbearing, stubborn father in a small rural village, and at several points in the film, the overstuffed, old-fashioned parlor prominently displays an Edison Amberola 30 and lots of Blue Amberola records. In the film we are seeing now, The Goose Woman from 1925, a cylinder phonograph provides not only nostalgia, but personal identity. Louise Dresser plays a former opera singer who gave up the stage to have a child, during which she lost her voice. Vicissitudes have forced her into alcoholism and living on a dilapidated farm where she raises geese. She still has a sense of her former self as a diva, however, which is tenuously preserved despite her dependence on gin, by her disintegrating scrapbooks, her Edison home model phonograph, and the record, one record left, she has of her voice. The distance of the times past is beautifully set up by director Clarence Brown, who uses the phonograph as a part of Dresser's identity, and the desperate care she shows towards her record in the machine through her alcoholic haze. When her son, who's played by Jack Pickford, Mary Pickford's brother, comes to visit her, he has no idea of what the memory of her voice means to her. And when he has an accident with her one record, the enormity of what he has done goes much further and deeper than simple, casual thoughtlessness. As I mentioned, phonographs were most prominent in comedies from very early days, mostly in cell props, but our final excerpt that we're going to have is a personal favorite of mine. This is a transitional film from silent to sound films in several ways, though the film you're about to see was made as a talking film. It was also released as a silent for Unwired Houses, and for many years, it was entirely mute, as the disc soundtrack was lost until the 1970s. The Hal Roach Studios had made a full commitment to making sound comedies in 1928-29 by making a contract with Victor. And the earliest of their sound comedies had entirely disc soundtracks, and several films exist without their tracks still. However, the neat thing about Roach was they not only wholeheartedly embraced the idea of sound comedies, they reflected this in the titles of their comedians' inaugural sound films. Charlie Chase's first talkie was called The Big Squawk. In fact, the very first Hal Roach talkie was called Hurdy Gurdy. Our gang made Small Talk. And what you're about to see is a sequence from Laurel and Hardy's exquisitely named Unaccustomed As We Are. Not only did Laurel and Hardy adapt nigh well perfectly from silent to sound films in this, they provide a view of the ubiquity and psychological influence the phonograph had achieved by 1929 in American life and in the films reflecting that culture in what I think may be the definitive sight and sound gag. I'll let this speak for itself. This does have sound.
Are we in the right apartment?
Oh, sure. She's a great scout. You gotta know her to understand. Honey, I've got a nice surprise for you. You've heard me speak about Stan, haven't you?
Yes.
That's him.
Well, what about it?
Well, we were down playing a little game of pool this afternoon, and he got hungry. And I told him about those big steaks that you cooked and the strawberry souffle with the whipped cream beat up in it and that good coffee you made
and some nuts.
Oh, I forgot to tell you. He likes nuts.
Oh, he does. Well, isn't that lovely?
Then I told him if he'd come up, you'd be glad to fix up.
Oh, you did. Well, get a load of this, big boy. I'm sick and tired of cooking for you and all the bums that you happen to bring up here for dinner. And I'm not going to do it any longer. If you think for a moment that all I'm going to do is stay in that kitchen, leave over that hot stove, I don't care what I told you. I'm telling you now that I'm not going to do it anymore. This is my birthday.
This boy's a friend of mine. I've known him for 5 years.
I don't care if you've known him for a hundred and 5 years. I'm not going to cook. And you're not going to make a slave out of me for all the bums that you have to bring up here for dinner. You're not trying. No, you've done it. You earn the money and I do the cooking. That's all I do. And besides, what else do I do? And all you keep up with it. I'm not trying anything. I'm just telling you something. That I'm not going to do it anymore. Now, all shut up. Gosh, I can't get a word in edgeways of you, too. Now, I listen to you. You listen to me. I'm simply sick and tired. I'm not going to stand it any longer. My mother told me that you'd make a slave out of me and keep me in this house till morning and tonight. And I'm not so sick and tired of it. And I'm not going to do it anymore. If you think for 1 minute that I'm going to go in that kitchen and cook for you and cook for you, I'm not. I'm just afraid you're not going to do it. My steps as well. Mother as well. No, it's not. If I'm not going to do it, I'm not going to. What do you mean by saying this when I'm trying to talk to you? You think so? Now I'm going home to my mother, that's all. I'm just sick and tired of it. I'm not going to stay any longer. Do you hear me?
Thanks very much.